Hello, and welcome to Required Reading, the podcast that revisits the most impactful books from our childhood. I'm your host, Erin Bowles. I am a writer, actor, and comedian. Today, our guest is Caroline Ely. She is a podcast host based out of LA, and she currently hosts Good Christian Fun with former guest Kevin T. Porter, a comedy podcast about the upside-down world of Christian pop culture now in its 8th year. Congratulations, that's incredible.
Hi, thank you. I'm so glad to be here. I'm very excited about this. Erin came on Good Christian Fun, and you were just a pure delight and such a good sport.
Oh my gosh, we talked about VeggieTales and the number of times that the Larry the Cucumbers, it's said once and it's such a toss away line. He goes, "Hi, Queen," fully integrated into my lexicon now.
It's a new compulsion you have. Just, hi,
Hi,
Queen.
Queen. It's huge.
Yeah,
It's
I'm glad we brought that into your life if it wasn't already there.
And I think we were talking about my hammock watching habits. I think that was the first thing I watched in that hammock
Really? That's how you
was
christened it? Oh my gosh. That's a good way to ease into that hammock, but I'm glad you've progressed into what sounds like some meatier topics in movies.
I mean, yeah, it's a lot of like classic movies that I've already seen before, which is
What are your latest watches? I grew up watching a lot of classic movies with my mom, which we'll probably
oh.
kind of get into because of
Yeah.
our book today.
The last one I watched was The Strange Woman with Hedy Lamarr, which
Oh.
had only come into my life because once I was in my mom's hometown, which is a little town in Kentucky, in an antique store, and I found a couple like movie posters from vintage magazines. And I found one that
Oh.
was this Hedy Lamarr movie, never heard of, which is like her disembodied head looking really sexy and like mysterious.
Oh, okay,
So I was like, I should watch the movie that this is from.
Is it good? I've never heard of that one, A Strange Woman.
It's kind of like good for her sort of genre.
Okay.
Like, yeah, it's this young, I guess like late 1800s woman who wants money and wants to be rich and comfortable. And so she marries this, she like has this long-standing romance with a guy her age, and she marries his dad. Because he's
Oh,
like the
got the
wealthy
money.
merchant, and does she
Wow.
kill him? And then she starts having a thing with, I think John Wayne is in it.
Oh my God. Wow. I'm looking at photos, stills from it. She gets to wear some incredible hats and, like, truly
Yes.
one of the most beautiful women to ever exist.
Gosh.
So glad she got on film. And then also, she was like a genius. I'm sure you've heard of this story. Yeah, crazy.
Yeah. Yeah, she has a memoir that I read. It was so disappointing. I hated it. And then I looked
No.
into it. She hated it. Like, she didn't write it. She sued about it and was like, "Do not put this on me. I did not write it."
Wait,
So
someone
it was so
claimed it was her
disappointing.
autobiography?
I think it was like set up by a studio, probably. And I think she maybe like wrote a core, like a base. And then the
What?
studio guys came in because her first movie was Ecstasy in I guess Germany, and it was very, very sexy. And I think she like wrote a standard autobiography, and they were like, "This is not sexy enough. This is not like what
Oh,
we're
right.
trying to
We want like the
sell."
tales of your affairs or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah, no Wi-Fi mentioned in there.
Yeah, what the hell?
Yeah, what are some of your favorite classic movies?
Oh, one of my favorites is Funny Face with Audrey Hepburn's musical where she's like falls in love with a geriatric Fred Astaire. And then I love Singing in the Rain. Gosh, On the Waterfront, The Sweet Smell of Success. Have you ever seen that movie? It's kind of a
I
random
haven't.
one,
I've
but it
been like meaning to forever. It's like
kind of blew
Tony
my mind when I watched it. Yeah, Tony
Curtis,
Curtis.
right?
Yeah. And Burt Lancaster.
I'm a huge fan of Norma Shearer. So I just rewatched A Free Soul with Lionel Barrymore and Clark Gable and
Whoa.
Leslie Howard. Transitioning into our book today from 1905 by Frances Hodgson Burnett, A Little Princess. What's your story with this book?
This book was so important to me as a kid, and I'm the youngest of three kids. And like, so when you're the youngest, like toys and books just sort of like flow into your life. They're not like given to you necessarily. They're just like there. And this is one of those books that was just around. We have a lot of books in my house and I was a big reader. And I've been trying to think, like, because of this podcast, what it was about this book that was so enrapturing for me. But I read this book over and over and over and over as a kid. It is just one of the books I kind of like latched onto. And it's not like I had grand theories about it or thoughts about it. I would just like read it front to back, be like, okay, and then move on and then come back to it over and over again. And I have some ideas of what it was, but it was just one of those books that I love to reread over and over again. It was really special to me.
Oh, I had never read it or read any of Hodgson Burnett. So I was so excited to be like, finally, we're going to get into it. We're going to crack it.
Okay, yay. I'm so glad that you came in blind and like as an adult can tell me what you think of this book, because it's one of those things I can't like quite parse what I thought of it as a kid versus now. And also, I'm so glad we did this podcast, because I had never been curious about Frances Hodgson Burnett at all, had mm-hmm. no idea what she was all about. And my other favorite book was Secret Garden. Mm-hmm. I didn't even know she wrote both of those books. Just independently, two books I loved very much and reread very often. So I almost chose Secret Garden, but Little Princess I was more into.
Wow. And she also, like, her big three is those two and Little Lord Fauntleroy, which has not been remembered as well.
No, just the name, I think, more than anything. Yeah, that one I was like, I need to go read that, because it was very big. But from what I was reading too, it was really just like a costume that Victorian mothers yeah. loved to put their little boys in more than anything, because he had like fancy hair and yes. frills. And then it kind of became a punchline. And so that's how little Lord Fauntleroy endures. But I don't know if it's worth a read. We'll see.
I don't know, but it is like a punchline. And I don't think anyone who uses the punchline has really read the book. But no. I did a lot of research on her, and jumping ahead, you know, Little Lord Fauntleroy, I think, is basically, like you said, she dressed up her boy like this.
Yeah.
And it became a thing because she had two sons. And when she had her second son, she was like, God damn, I really wanted a girl. So I'm still going to name him Vivian, and I'm going to long hair, velvet coats, so much lace, so much frills. And the book was wildly popular for some reason.
Yeah, I guess maybe a lot of Victorian mothers had the same problem. And this was such a wonderful solution. Just like, just go ahead and do it anyway, girl. You know, really, yes. like kind of a lovely gender blending going on there, a looseness exactly. with it.
And I feel like you so often hear the opposite of like father wants a son and gets a girl and she gets treated like crap. So this is like a nice change.
Yeah.
That like femininity is the wanted thing.
Yeah.
Nice. But she's got a fasting life.
Yes, please tell us about it.
So she's born in 1849 in the UK. Her mother's family is like pretty well to do, and her father is an ironmonger. And they're pretty comfortable. They have two maids. She's the middle of five kids, I think, with two older brothers and two younger sisters. And then when she's four, her dad dies, and her mom takes up the business. She goes into her grandmother's care, and that's how she really like develops a love of reading and telling stories. And then as time goes by, the business falls on hard times. She has to leave school around age 12. And then around age 15, they decide to move to Tennessee to work with an uncle who has a really successful dry goods store. But it's 1865, and as soon as the Civil War ends, all of the kind of business in Tennessee leaves. So his store falls on hard times. And she starts writing 17, 18, 19 to earn money for the family, publishing in magazines. She like writes for 5 years, pretty much 24/7. And then around age 20, she is able to move the family into a better home. She marries at 23 to a doctor. They move to Paris, And she, again, finances his medical training with her writing. They move to DC. She starts writing novels, and then she also starts writing children's fiction. She writes a play called Esmeralda, which is the longest running Broadway play in the 19th century. Insane. She is, and then all of her novels, at least her children's novels, are serialized in magazines and then become printed as novels. So she's 38 when A Little Princess is printed first in magazines and then 50 when it's printed in 1905 as a novel. She writes and produces stage versions of Little Lord Fauntleroy and A Little Princess, I think because like another one of her novels gets turned into a play without her consent. And she's like, we're not
Yes.
doing this anymore. I'm gonna do it myself.
Yeah, and
She
she
gets,
there was some
yeah.
sort of like landmark copyright law that was enacted because of that, because she said, you're stealing my IP, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then she gets a divorce in 1898, which is sort of critically received in the press. And then she's a successful novelist for adults and just kind of goes back to the UK and has this beautiful garden where she writes. And 1887, when it's first published in magazines, which is, but I was so fascinated how like the early kind of beats of her life so similarly, at least with her father dying, line up with A Little Princess. The story of A Little Princess is very, very rich girl goes to school, her father dies, and she becomes the servant and is very, very maltreated at this school. And it turns out that her father's business partner in India, there's miscommunication, and the diamond mines that he has are actually successful. So he is spending all of his time trying to find little Sarah Crewe to give her all of her money and reunite her and sort of become a father figure to her. I had never read it before, and I thought it was really sweet. And there's something about Hodgson Burnett that, even not having read Secret Garden, she has a style that is like so tangible.
I was reading into that and I just couldn't believe what a woman Frances was and how she just blew me away just finding out this story. And it's yet a my like millionth reminder of how much we underestimate what women were doing in this time in the turn of the century and how a lot of things were more progressive than we remember or imagine. A lot of things weren't, but her providing and like sustaining her family of six at like 19 years old with her writing and is so fascinating. And I think that was interesting too. I was thinking a lot about like how that shapes the kind of author you become when you're like really laser focused on commercial success from the get-go. And this isn't like you're a rich person, you're gonna try writing as a hobby and pull from Greek mythology or whatever. You're just like, we need to know what sells. And so, and for a long time, she was writing, from what I understand, kind of like very schmaltzy, morally tales for children that like sold really well and were like tidy. And then these two books, Secret Garden and Little Princess, came out much later. And I think it's important that they came after the death of her first son, who was 16 when he died from tuberculosis, which is a pain I cannot imagine. And she adored her sons and I think at one point was even a stay-at-home mom for a good stretch and was just taking care of them. Either way, loved her children very, very much, and that was a devastating thing for her. And she was kind of like never the same after he passed. And these books were written after that. And I think possibly because of that, there's a little bit more of an edge to them, and they have a little bit less of that like schmaltzy corniness. And that's perhaps why they've endured so much. There is still plenty that is kind of corny about this book, but it's like it's a hard read also. It's very, very devastating in a lot of ways and very tragic. And so the happy ending is all the more satisfying and amazing afterward. But anyway, back to Frances. What a gal. And like I just can't believe she was doing all of this. And it was helpful too to like finally understand her better and then understand Sarah Crewe and this story so much better too. And how much autobiographical material was making it into this book about Sarah. One of her great strengths is she's just like loves to tell stories, which must have been how Frances was with her siblings of just like weaving a yarn all the time and so, beloved by little kids for that. Also, losing her father at a really young age, like Sarah does. And she was 3 when her dad died. So I don't know if they had this like beautiful relationship that's described in the book, but it clearly set the whole family on a path for a long time of like a lot of hard times. And that fantasy that every kid has of like someday you'll be discovered and it'll be your princess and you'll be magic and all these things will happen to you. That probably like was a fantasy that she had for a while as a kid, and that kind of sustained her. And so it's cool to see like how much she must have poured herself into this book and why it feels so true and amazing. Oh, and the other thing that I love about Frances that I found out was like, Frances was not like bad with her money, but she like loved fancy things. And she, her nickname was Fluffy because she was like so fancy. And she would like have lace and furs and like loved a luxury good. And like the way she describes luxurious things in this book is so delicious. And I think a big reason why I like latched onto this as a kid is just everything sounds so fabulous and so nice. Like when Sarah is rich and they'll describe like the trim she had on her dress and her special little shoes and the seashell buttons or whatever it is, like it's so visceral and so amazing. And so anyway, it's fun to know like that was kind of also Frances's just sort of like pet hobby. It was loving nice things.
If you go on her Wikipedia page, there is like every picture of her, she she knows she's cooking, like she
to the nines, just dripping in swag. It's so it's one of those things where you're kind of afraid sometimes to learn about your author, like especially from these eras, and then to find out she was like kind of fab in almost every way. It was so satisfying for me.
Yeah. And she got a divorce and she got a second divorce. She married an actor and then realized like, oh, I don't like him. And he took me for my money.
Yeah. Just be Frances. And she was famous. And oh yeah, the second husband was interesting. I need to like, I want to find out more about this, but it sounds like he was kind of like her little boy toy lover.
Yes.
And then it was becoming a problem because she was still married at the time, I think, when she was with him, but she and her husband were fully separated. And so then because of the scandal that was starting to brew, they divorced, she got married to him. And then that guy thought he was going to try to control her and her money and like become her manager and everything. And that's, I mean, if you've studied old Hollywood, that's a very old tale and it usually ends terribly, you know, see Judy Garland. But Frances said no. It just kicked into the curb right away, which is just, I just love that about her.
Her writing, like you said, is so rich at the beginning and at the end. And I think that's part of the text and her skill as a writer, but also because, and I think it's informed by this in her own life as well, because of the deprivation. She loses everything. And then her father's business partner is living next door. There's so much of it that like is so exciting and agonizing of like, he is living next door, searching Paris and Moscow, looking for her. And she's seeing his,
she's
like,
right there
through the window. And the butler's creep across to like put little beautiful things in her room and feed her.
Oh, I have chills.
And we should talk about why she is called a little princess.
Well, let's talk about Sarah Crewe, because Sarah is like just such a fantastic heroine and she's basically perfect, which can sometimes be very irritating to read. But Sarah, like when she arrives at this school, she is rich as fuck. Like she is balls to the wall so rich. I don't know why her dad put her in one of the like crummier schools, it sounds like. I think because he was from another country, he just like had a friend who was like, put her here. And she goes to Miss Minchin's school, which if you just didn't clock it in the name, I don't know what to tell you. And so Sarah arrives already really wealthy, and Miss Minchin also, I think, is so interesting because she runs the school with her sister. She's a businesswoman. Like, very plainly, they talk about that often in the book. Like, she's good with money. She knows where her customers are. She knows how to run shit. But she's cruel and she's greedy. And she takes Sarah on. She's very insecure also. And a lot of terrible things we found out about Miss Minchin. But Miss Minchin, I like was trying to have a little bit more of a compassionate take on her too as I was reading through, of like, she's such a good villain, you know, she's just like spiteful and jealous and petty and like fully evil. But there's something kind of fascinating about her too, and the way that she'll manipulate and connive with certain parents that she loves, and then figure out which children are the ones that she should take care of. And so she treats Sarah very wonderfully at the beginning, but very early on, distrusts and dislikes Sarah because Sarah constantly flouts her expectations. Because although she's super, super wealthy, Sarah has absolutely zero entitlement, and she doesn't care about her stuff really at all, unless it like brings somebody else some kind of pleasure. But she wears it all really well, and she like loves a frill. She loves a gorgeous little gown, and they describe her like dancing dress that's like a pink
Yes.
organza, like frothy thing. So sweet. And she shares everything, and she's really compassionate, and she immediately befriends the kind of low and the disregarded of the school. There's Lottie, the baby of the school, who's just always whining, and she has terrible issues with attention. And Sarah takes her in as like her baby because they both lost their mothers.
Yeah.
Very
That's
sweet.
such
And
an
then
incredible moment where Lottie is like, but my mom is dead. And Sarah's like, mine too. And I'm not doing this. I'm being it very mean. And Sarah, of course, is like, girl, mine is also dead. And you don't see me doing this. Sarah is perfect.
Sarah
Yeah.
is perfect. She's perfect. And she's perfect in that she's like not a goody two shoes, but she's kind and she is unbeatable. And
Yeah.
she is so strong in her conviction and her morality and the kind of person she wants to be, no matter what is happening around her,
Yeah.
which you just can't help but like worship her. By the end,
Yeah.
she's just so. I mean, what did you think of Sarah as a character? Did you find her kind of irritating or like too
No.
perfect? Or what did you think?
I think from like a writing perspective, I was like, where are we getting some flaws here? But I think like Burnett does such an incredible job with the interiority of the characters from Sarah to Minchin. You understand them so clearly. And I think Sarah finds fault in herself. And I think that's informed mention. I think she's like, maybe I am being too proud, maybe. But the ongoing thing is like, I'm not gonna let them get to me. And I mean, it's the quote everyone pulls from the book is like, a princess is a princess determined by her behavior, not by her surroundings. And I am going to be a princess in my behavior, in my kindness, in my generosity, in my understanding, in my patience. And it's never like, I'm so much better than them. It's just like, this is how I will conduct myself, and this is important to me.
Yeah, like for me to feel proud of myself, is it because of my station or what I have or how well I'm liked? It's because of how I'm able to be the same person in my kindness, in my care, no matter what happens, which is like amazing. And to be true to
Yeah,
yourself.
absolutely. And Minchin is like aware that she is being silly. She is aware that she's being unfair to this kid. But you don't sympathize with her, but you understand where she is coming of like this kid gets under her skin because she is perfect, because she is not, because Minchin has this like emotional immaturity and Sarah is not reacting in the way that she's supposed to.
Yeah, and mention rules by fear, which Sarah just doesn't respond to or ever feel from her. She always just sees exactly like what little power move she's trying to pull, which for an authoritarian is very, very frustrating.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. She's at first nicknamed Princess because of the external circumstances, because Minchin does like parade her around as look at the quality of my students, of look at sort of the economic class we attract. And then it becomes sort of mean in that, like, oh, she thinks she's better than us, even though she doesn't from the other kids. And then it does become this thing of like she deports herself in the same way despite her circumstances. And it's that classic line of like a princess is a princess even without everything. And when that line came, I was like, oh, that's put it on a pillow. There it is. We got it. Nice and clear.
Yeah, and so you get to the center core of the book, which is when through misunderstanding, her father had invested all of his money in these diamond mines. And everyone at the school is aware of the diamond mines, and Sarah's like now going to be even more millionaire-y, and they fail. And her father is so distraught that he dies. And that is so painful. And the way that she talks about what Sarah goes through in that grieving, it's so
Yeah.
vivid. And I don't know, you feel like Frances understood grief very well and was able to remember that this is still a little girl. So like, how does a little girl understand? And we know from the beginning of the book that Sarah and her father had this really, really, really special bond, and it was just them in their house. And he thought she was hilarious and odd, and he spoiled her because she was just so sweet and like whatever. Anyway, they're all perfect. But
yes.
So all of a sudden Sarah has this complete fall from grace. Her father's funds are cut off. It's also, oh my gosh, the contrast of them being at Sarah's party, her birthday party, where Minchin has spent all this money making it super hyper fabulous, you know, knowing that she could send the bill to daddy, and to find out not only is there no daddy, there's no money coming back for little Sarah. And Minchin actually can't wait to humble Sarah so quickly, and breaks up the party, announces it to the whole school, embarrasses her, tells her to go find her black dress. Sarah doesn't have black dresses. Sarah is fabulous. She has one from when she was like three, and so it doesn't fit. And puts that on and immediately is like, you're going to be a servant. And Minchin, you know, she tries to play it like, you should be even grateful. I'm taking care of you. I'm left with nothing. In fact, I'm losing money now that I've spent all this money on your little birthday cakes. But you can tell she's really like savoring the opportunity to finally put Sarah in what she feels is her place, and to kind of get rid of this girl who is undefeatable. So then Sarah's like, all happens once, finds out her dad's dead, puts on the horrible outfit, is stuck up in the attic in the room with the rats where it's freezing cold, loses all of her stuff. None of the girls are allowed to talk to her, and she's put to work. It's very, very, very fast. Boom, boom, boom. Her fall from grace. And it's there that she's like, decides how she's going to react to this. And she's grieving her father, and her father was a soldier. And so for her, she's like, I can't just be, you know, sad and wallow in this. Like, a soldier would handle this with a lot of strength. Have you ever seen, okay, I don't know if you have seen it, but there's a Shirley Temple rendition of this book.
I have not seen it, but I have the Wikipedia page up, and just it's in Technicolor, and just the tiny little thumbnail is gorgeous. It's of her birthday party in front of her cake.
Magic.
Gorgeous. Yes. but it's that, and I'm glad you brought up the movies, because they sound like they really differ in certain plot aspects. So I do want to bring that up.
I bring that up because Shirley Temple was such fantastic casting for Sarah Crewe, because there is no one that does like a stiff of her lip better than Shirley, you know? And there's the moment where she kind of decides like, okay, I can't really fathom this. So what I'm going to do is pretend now. And I am a prisoner in the Bastille in France, and I'm a political prisoner basically. And I just need to endure this, and I'm not going to let them get me down, and I'm going to keep enduring everything. And then Frances goes on to describe in great detail some really horrendous stuff that she has to endure. She's like driven to the brink of starvation, basically. She's sent out constantly on chores outside in London. And because Sarah is also like brilliant, she's very, very smart, they send her for like complex chores, like paying bills and like negotiating contracts and stuff. Also, she's tutoring the kids at the same time too. And not only is she doing like just household shit, she's also expected to keep studying so that she can be a teacher to the kids. So like every off hour she has, she's still like trying to study a textbook. And in her mind too, she's like, I can't get behind this poor thing. She just like, Frances really is just like, I'm gonna just like run her through it.
And now with that detail, I'm connecting the fact that Frances left school at 12. And wondering how that interacted with each other. But that it is so, I'm just, my eyes just landed on, there is a Hello Kitty version of this, apparently. What?
Now, hold on. I gotta look on that. Hello Kitty. Little princess.
It's very vivid in both the luxury and also like her hunger. There are holes in her shoes, and they send her out on the rainiest, muddiest, dreariest day, and it gets in her shoes. And Burnett is an incredible writer in that vividness, even in the poverty.
Yeah, and even in her lowly status, there's people that are even lower than Sarah. There's Becky, who's the servant, basically the slave of the house. Becky has no family, nothing. She is in Sarah's position as well. And Sarah was kind to her when she was a wealthy little student, and remains like, she and Becky become allies, basically.
Yeah.
God, poor Becky. She breaks my
Poor
heart.
Becky. The one thing that I was like, is that when Sarah goes to the, he's referred to as the Indian gentleman, he's the mine guy, to their house. Sarah is still like her maid. She's not like another kid adopted into the family,
Okay,
but
yeah, we
also
need to
I don't
talk about this.
yeah.
Yeah,
That was the
so
only thing where I was like, I don't know about that.
there a thing that is very itchy to me about this book is Francis's relationship with wealth
Yeah.
and
Ooh, say so
with
much.
rich people and poverty. It's very fascinating. It's a very like it's hard to not impose like my own like modern understanding of wealth, but like clearly Francis understands that there is a poverty issue in England around the world, and she very accurately is describing what happens to literal children when they don't have money. They become a Becky and they're stuck in a house and they are truly at the mercy of anybody, whatever they want to do with them. There's no police coming to check on Becky. There's no social worker checking if she's eating, if she's okay. Basically, the women of this house could run her into starvation or illness or death, and no one would check on her and no one would care. And she describes that very well. And so you are very like worried about the precarity of Becky's situation and therefore Sarah as well. And then also you have her describing a beggar on the street too, what she calls a beggar, which is another little girl who has no family, nothing, and is sitting outside the bakery, also starving to death while Sarah is starving. And Sarah, through some magical means, gets some extra food and gives most of it to this girl as well. So you know that Frances understands there's a problem here, and these children are forgotten and lost, and they're falling through the cracks. And there is nobody there to save them, really. But it's a very like middle class understanding of what would save them, which is like one random person will have a good heart and will help them if they feel
It's
like
not
it.
systemic change.
No, there's
Yeah.
no institutional change. There's no, how could the law allow for this? You know, it's truly just like, well, I hope, you know, some rich person just kind of opens their hearts up. That's kind of their job. Otherwise, I don't know what to do. And also, yeah, like you said, when Sarah finally does become wealthy again, she just kind of like steps back into it like an old shoe. You know, I don't think she has like a complicated understanding of her wealth now that she's been this low beyond being generous, which she already was. And
It's
like you
true.
said, she decides to save Becky by making Becky her servant, her house. So she keeps Becky again, who's a child. Becky's not like an adult who could choose this career. Becky is maybe
Yeah.
12 in the book, forces her
Yeah,
back into
Becky.
labor. And that's seen as like
Yeah.
kind of a sweet little bow tie on this situation. And then another like kind of callback is when Sarah is wealthy, she goes back to the bakery, and the baker took that beggar woman in because she was so moved by that woman child. She was so moved by Sarah's generosity. She was like, yeah, she works for me now. And it's
Yeah,
like,
I was expecting to be like, I adopted her
yes.
and now she's part, but it was like, yeah, she worked here. And does she maybe sleep in the bakery?
In the bakery, and that's like it's so amazing because it's better than her being on the street. It's rough, it's not good, and
Yeah.
it's
And
so
Sarah sort
interesting
of
of her.
asks, like, if you see hungry kids, can you feed them? And that's sort of it. It's,
That's kind of it. Yeah, it's like
yeah.
it's just like charity. Like that's the solution to the terrible issue of poverty. And so that is very wrong and itchy and like uncomfortable. And also just like generally the wealthy in this book are just kind of seen as also pretty much morally good. The people that are described as having a lot, there's the big family, they have a lot. They end up being like the lawyer to the dying man who was her dad's business partner who ultimately helps her find. They're all like so extravagantly rich. And the fact that the very rich man has this school full of children next to him with slaves in it And it's only his other little servant that's like, what if we just did something nice for these poor slave girls in the attic? And he's like, yes, that would help me feel better.
Yeah,
You know,
it
he
is.
does
You're
he
right.
doesn't
That'll
rescue
help me
them. He
feel
doesn't call the
better.
police. He's not like, hey, what's going on? Why are these girls starving in the attic and like have no fire or blankets? You know? The generosity, the charity, it's mostly seemed as a way to like make a sad rich person feel better. To demonstrate maybe their moral superiority when they act generously sometimes. And that's kind of it. And there's no other examination of wealth otherwise. It's kind of like just a magic thing that happens to you.
It's very trickle-down economics.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
And also even just like the description of a princess and like what a princess does is a very like childlike, uncomplicated understanding of monarchies as well. And it's like princesses are like
Absolutely.
not good on the
No, it absolutely is like, I like this definition of princess. I don't know where you're getting it. But great.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I've never met this kind of princess, but okay, go off, I guess, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask, there's this 1995 film that I feel like is so beloved that's directed by Alfonso Cuarón. Did you watch that at all? Or the
I
English
did
trilogy at
not. I
all?
didn't get around to it. I think, like, also when I saw that come out as a kid, there was something about me that was like purist about it. Because I think they changed a
Yeah.
lot in that
They
movie. And I
do.
think I didn't
Yeah.
like that. So I just like, I was like, I'm gonna ignore it.
I haven't seen it either, but it really stuck in my teeth because the dad lives.
Yes.
He's a wounded and missing in action soldier, and they're later reunited. And there's some differences, it seems, about like they shift the time period a little bit. I think they shift it to New York, which I don't care about. But I think that is like almost dangerous. Like, I think there is a great honesty in saying like sometimes parents die and they are not coming back. You may find another adult in your life that you can care for, but dead people stay dead. And I think there's something dangerous about a movie being like, may you're a kid who's like lost your parent and maybe they're still out there. And you spend ages and
Yeah.
ages and ages being like, maybe they're still out there. That rankled me.
I know, me too. They do that in the Shirley Temple movie too. Like her dad disappears because, yeah, he's wounded in action. And then he's like has PTSD basically afterward and kind of lost his mind. So he doesn't even remember he has a daughter. And that's why he hasn't found her. But when he finally sees her, he kind of like starts to come back to himself. I think you're right that like it does kind of undermine the core tragedy and the realness of this book. And I think the reason a lot of this book has kind of stood the test of time is like for a long time there is no one coming for Sarah and there is no rescue. And like, what do you do with that? And how do you still rise to the occasion? And because she did it so well, she's rewarded with a new parent, basically. At the same time, I'm kind of like, is it better or worse that like this random man becomes her dad versus like her actual dad is just found? I don't know.
And I like what you said about like she seems to earn it, which I think is true, which is like every kid deserves a parent.
Yeah, that's another like very Victorian story, right? Thing of like, oh, if you are just like actually beaten to the curb and you still don't cry about it, you have earned one good treat. You
Yeah,
get
she
one hot
really
cross
doesn't
bun.
cry. That's
Yeah, there's something like so tragic too about like, we shouldn't expect this of a child, but we admire her so much of like, you know, truly never letting it get her down. She almost, like you said, she pretty much almost never cries the entire book. She like gets to the brink and she says, I won't cry. Like, I won't give them that satisfaction. And it's like, you should cry. You're 10. Like, this is really, really bad.
You understand like where she's coming from of like, I don't want to give them the satisfaction, and then you're all like an adult looking at a child and you're like, no, baby, let that
Yeah.
out,
Like,
let
ooh,
me
the issues are
live.
coming for you later.
Yes. Oh gosh. I wanted to ask your relationship generally with like there's such a huge element of Sarah Kerr's character as she's telling these stories and she's able to train these kids. Was that at all you said you read this a lot. Were you a big reader? Were you a big she is an imaginer and everyone around her is like, how do you do that? How do you imagine things? And that sort of was like, you just do it to me.
Yeah. I mean, you're a writer, so you probably relate so much to Sarah and like her ability to just pull it out. I think, yes, I was a big pretender, and but my stories had no creativity. It was almost always princess, will the prince find her, et cetera. Not a lot of variation there. So I think, like, I can't like claim I am as creative as Sarah as far as like narrative storytelling. I love, love, love to read, and I love to dress up. But I think what I liked about Sarah and what I wanted to claim so much was like her specialness. And there's this is like a really weird detail that, like, as a kid, it was so important to me, which is like Sarah has green eyes. And I remember staring in the mirror, like getting really, really close to my eyeball. And like, my eyes are like just barely green. Okay. Like, they're like mostly kind of just gray. You really have to like want it to see it. And like, once I figured out I also have green eyes, like that became core to my personality. And like, to this day, it's like if someone says I have blue eyes, I'm like, no,
Like green eyes, like so
like
cruel.
Sarah Grew. And then just like generally, yeah, her specialness of like just everything is within her. And she, everyone's just kind of like blown away by like, you're so smart and you're kind of pretty, but not in a normal pretty way. And you're so clever, and you're so like wise, and you're so generous, and like so popular, even though there's some girls that kind of hate you because you're so amazing. Like, all of these things are just catnip for a little girl, I think.
And it's interesting that there's like as a narrative thing of like you can have such a successful narrative with a perfect character.
Yes.
I think that's always like such a hallmark of like they have to be flawed. We have to have them. And she does like emerge from the beginning of the narrative as a fully formed perfect entity. And you're like,
Yes.
how'd you get this way, girl? I mean, she's definitely like it's her and her dad against the world in India. I love
Yeah. Oh,
how
and
they're
also she
like,
just speaks French
yeah.
fluently sometimes, just so.
Because her mom is French. And it's like she died when she was maybe born or something, but she does it. She does it.
She had a French
She,
maid.
oh my gosh. Of course she did.
She did.
There's a moment where she's like in her little attic window and she looks across to the Indian servant across the way and he like starts calling to her and she speaks in perfect Hindu or Urdu to him. And I was like, imagine that moment from his perspective of like
Yeah.
foreign country, you don't know what you're doing, you're working for a guy, and then there's this little tiny white girl who speaks your foreign language back to you, or your native tongue back to you. And
Isn't that
what
such
does
a
that
great
actor do
moment?
at that moment?
Yeah. Oh my God. And like, talk about special too, right? Because she just looks like any other girl that like works in a house and kind of looks like haggard. And then all of a sudden, like, outpours out of her mouth, perfect, polite, you know, in your native language. And she doesn't make a big like show of it, you know, she's just happy to see someone that she recognizes, you know, like I think as a kid, like I was not perfect, but I like definitely had perfectionism like in my soul and like really, really wanted to be like overachiever extraordinary. And so she just is that, you know, while not being like hateable.
Oh my
I think she's
gosh.
actually a really good contrast to the heroine in A Secret Garden, who I didn't like because Mary Lennox is a brat and she's mean and she's like never happy with her situation and constantly complaining and pushing boundaries and being irritating and not understanding anything. And just, but because of that, everything works and like she unfolds kind of a wonderful world. And so, Frances didn't only write perfect girls, but she wrote Sarah this way.
Were there any like big surprises now rereading it? Because obviously you read it a lot as a kid. Revisiting it as an adult, was there anything that you were like, I did not catch that? My perspective has totally changed.
I think mainly, yeah, just sort of like the very uncomplicated understanding of class and wealth in this book was pretty shocking to read now. And I was almost kind of nervous of like, oh, I hope Aaron doesn't think I'm a shithead, you know, because I love this book. But like, it was, that's a big thing. Like, as a kid, you kind of take this as like for granted and almost even like a very complex understanding of the world. And then as an adult, you read this again and you're like, wow, everyone is truly like enslaving children. And you just kind of hope the magic claw comes out of the sky and plucks you out of it. Like, that's the best we can do. And surprising, like, given Frances's background and what she went through, you would think she would have a little bit more rage at the system, but maybe she was like a classic bootstraps, you know, like a entrepreneur. Yeah. And she's like, well, I got out of there, you know.
I wonder both what spending that time in the U.S. in the post-war period maybe informed that. And I mean, the fact that she did bootstrap it. She reminded me a lot of Louisa May Alcott. And they did meet once, actually.
Yeah.
And I think Louisa May Alcott, or like their shared publisher, might have been like, try writing for kids. And I didn't look for this in my research. I wonder if she like really did any charitable works.
Yeah, in my cursory reading, she was generous. Like, she did take care of like her family, and then I think several extended relatives. She like got them homes, but I don't think she was like a great philanthropist, as far as what I read. Of like, she started some, you know, charity to help the poor children all around her that she's aware of. You know, she probably just like tossed a coin to them here and there, and was like, "Lucky you."
You're welcome.
Yeah. All right, back to my chocolates.
Oh my gosh. Fluffy, you said?
Fluffy, the notorious Incredible. Fluffy. Yeah, the other just surprise is learning about Frances Moore and how much I like kind of grew to admire what she went through and how she got to this point and then was still writing after a great tragedy and was a mother and, you know, did it all back in the day and seemed to mostly kind of live a pretty good life.
Yeah. This is the oldest book I've done in a minute for the show.
Oh, really? Okay.
So it was not ever, but yeah, for a while. I think the earliest I've gone lately is like the 60s, maybe the 50s, with like James and Giant Peach and things like that. So it was really nice to like have something very meaty to dive into.
Yeah.
Like the book that I did before this is the first Warrior Cats book. And there's not a lot to dive in there into the research. It's like a British lady who loves cats and horses.
I didn't even know about this series. This sounds great.
Oh, it's like feral cats in the woods.
Oh, yeah.
It's intense.
I don't know what else I expected.
Is there anything you know you wanted to talk about that we haven't covered?
The only other thing I pulled was a quote from Burnett, and perhaps why I feel a little bit of kinship with her. And this is one of her quotes about her writing. Burnett wished above all to spread joy to readers as well as the people in her life. And she's quoted, "There ought to be a tremendous lot of natural, splendid happiness in the life of every human being." I think that's quite true. And I think that she brought that to those characters and especially to children. And this book and The Secret Garden, I think, unlocked a lot of that joy. And especially for like little girls, you know, having a secret world or a secret pride or a power or something kind of witchy or magic that happened to you and that only you know about and you deserve it. That is like, that is a gift, I think, to give to kids and to have them feel that way. And it does sustain you through a lot of difficulty. And like, I was bullied as a kid here and there, you know, and like, my attitude was very much like Sarah too, of just like, take it on the chin, don't let them get you, don't let them like think that you are wavering or whatever. And like, in fact, maybe even be kind to them, because that like really pisses them off, you know. So I think there's a lot, although there's some kind of complicated things about this book, there's a lot about Sarah that inspires me as a kid and like I still really admire today.
I think it's very important for kids to have their secrets. And there's some great sequences when the rich man is starting to give her things and especially feeding her. The other kids are like, her cheeks are looking plump.
Yeah.
Like, not tired anymore.
It's peppy. Yeah. I mean, we didn't even talk about that, but when they describe like what he does in her room and like the coziness, the bed that she wakes up in and how it's so fluffy and she still thinks she's dreaming for a long time because it feels so warm and so good. And there's a fire going for the first time ever. And then this like big cauldron of soup in a beautiful dish on a table. Like all of those details are like still with me, or so visceral and so delightful. And like the creature comforts of it all are just so, so warm and like imaginative.
And if I remember correctly, that kind of sequence is pretty shortly after she and Becky really imagine like a beautiful night in the little attic. And she's like, you know, I have like a piece of cloth from my old trunk and we can use that as a tablecloth. And maybe if we
Ugh.
imagine a fire there, we'll feel it. And then right on the heels, you get all of those things materialize. It's so
Oh,
sweet.
yeah, it's so sweet. And they have that little special thing they finally decorate, and that's the first time Miss Minchin decides to walk up to the attic and it completely destroys it. And then right after, you get her magical gift. Yeah, it's such a great, like, she's so good with those contrasts of like, you're just like, nothing could get worse. And then all of a sudden, it's so beautiful.
It is the empathy is really startling, and it's just constant understanding. And maybe especially for children's literature, you don't need a flawed character because it is aspirational. Because it is, I wonder if I could be this. She's a really special kind of character in the literary canon.
Yeah, she's kind of like Anne of Green Gables in some ways too, you know, like a bit misunderstood, but kind of like you can't get her down no matter what it is. And like that very nature is what kind of irritates people, but it's also like her salvation and her specialness, you know.
Yeah. Well, would you consider this required reading?
Absolutely. It must be required reading from childhood to adulthood. I'm so glad it like held up, basically. You know, there was part of me that was a little worried when I picked it up. And I'm glad you liked it too. I wasn't like, again, sure if this is just something that like I liked as a pet book from my childhood or if it was still good. Another funny story about this book, I bought it at a book sale at my library for a dollar. When I knew we were going to do this. And then it had like, I think it had original illustrations by someone named Birch. And it's not like an original print. It was like, you know, old. And the librarian that sold it to me, she was like, oh, this has the original illustrations. You should go look this person up. And I was like, amazing. Didn't do that. And then, but the illustrations are so important with this book. And I highly recommend you find a copy or look it up or like look up these illustrations because they're just very sporadic and sparse, but they just send everything home so wonderfully. So I had that book and then I took it to my sister's house and they got a brand new puppy and the puppy ate the book. So it's just shredded. And so my sister felt so bad. She bought me a brand new rendition. So now I have this lovely,
I love those. I have that
my blurs.
version of Little Women. I love
Yes.
those, that like quartet. Oh, I love that.
Yes. This is in that great girlhood canon of books. So, anyways, now, but this has very different illustrations that are like almost like darker and like scratchier and scrawlier and very like. And Sarah's always like this very dark figure at the center of it. And often you don't even see her face in these illustrations. It's really interesting. So, definitely recommend picking up a copy and just paging through it at least. They're really cool.
Nice. Well, now that we've reached the end, is there anything you'd like to plug? Of course, go check out Good Christian Fun.
Yes, good Christian fun. You do not have to be a Christian to listen to it. It's not a devotional. In fact, a lot of Christians are upset with me about this show. we carry on. It's very fun. I've been doing it years with my friend Kevin. We talk about like CCM bands and movies and VeggieTales, of course, anything's like that. Yeah, that's where you can. And you can find me at Caroline Sparts on Instagram or TikTok.
Well, thank you so much. I am
Wait, do I get to
going
say my
to.
required reading? Okay. Reading this book reminded me like my favorite era of writing, like kind of the sweet spot for me is like 1880s to like 1910 because there's like a modernism happening in the writing, but it's not full like avant-garde postmodernism. There's still a lot of like, I don't know, guardrails and like a little bit regimented. So it's like creative in the rails of that time. So in that vein, I highly recommend reading anything by D.H. Lawrence, but especially maybe The Rainbow or Women in Love. Recommend that.
Nice. Ooh, hell yeah. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you for letting me like spout off for a long time about Little Princess. What a treat that I so rarely get. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, I loved it. Well, if we feel good, I'm gonna turn off the recording.
Yay. Bye bye.